It's being called the most restrictive abortion ban in the nation. This hour, perspectives on Iowa's new fetal heartbeat law. To River from Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. The new Iowa law is slated to take effect July 1st, and it bans physicians from performing most abortions after a fetal heartbeat is detected. This hour, several perspectives on the contentious law. Katarina Sestarek on the court challenge to the law, then three Iowa lawmakers, each with very different views. After that, in the second half hour, historian Leslie Regan, the author of When Abortion Was a Crime, takes us back before the Roe v. Wade Supreme Court decision in 1973. Perspectives on Iowa's new fetal heartbeat law. First, this news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's being called the most restrictive abortion ban in the nation. The new Iowa law, slated to take effect July 1st, bans physicians from performing most abortions after a fetal heartbeat is detected. Now, a heartbeat can typically be detected around the sixth week of pregnancy. That's before many women realize they're pregnant. This hour, several perspectives on the contentious new law. In just a few minutes, we'll hear from three Iowa lawmakers, each with very different views, a Democrat who is against the change, a Republican who voted for it, and a Republican who was one of just six in the party who felt he could not support the new fetal heartbeat law. Then in the second half hour, some historical context. Historian Leslie Regan, the author of When Abortion Was a Crime, takes us back before Roe v. Wade, that Supreme Court decision in 1973. But before all that, the law is being challenged by Planned Parenthood of the Heartland and the American Civil Liberties Union of Iowa. IPR's Katarina Sestarek joins me now to explain the legal battle surrounding the case. Hello, Katarina.
Hi, Ben.
Take us through the arguments. Planned Parenthood, the ACLU of Iowa, and the Emma Goldman Clinic are suing Governor Kim Reynolds over this law. What are their arguments?
Right. They say the law would make it so hard to get an abortion in Iowa that it would effectively ban abortion in the state. And they say that would go against constitutional precedent reached in past cases that say that people have the right to get an abortion. They also say it would severely jeopardize the health, safety, and welfare of all Iowa women, and that some of the exceptions that are included in the law are not adequate and would still put a lot of women at risk.
Mm-hmm. So this is being pursued in the Iowa court system rather than the federal courts. What is the significance of that?
Right. So because the lawsuit makes claims under the Iowa Constitution and not the U.S. Constitution, it's highly unlikely that this lawsuit would ever appear in federal courts. And that's something that supporters of the law really wanted to happen. Some of them said they wanted that to happen because they were hoping that this law could eventually end up as a challenge to the U.S. Supreme Court's 1973 Roe v. Wade decision that legalized abortion. They were hoping that this law could sort of be a vehicle that could challenge that decision if the courts were to become more conservative in the future. And so that sort of rules that out as an option at this point.
Mm-hmm. There's been discussion about who will be representing the state and if Iowa taxpayers will be, will taxpayer money be used to defend this law?
The Thomas More Society will be representing the state. They're a conservative law firm from Chicago. They have a history of defending anti-abortion rights activists and other conservative causes. The Iowa Executive Council, which is some of the top officials in Iowa, has approved the hiring of this law firm. And even back in the early stages of when this law was making it was just a bill and it was making its way up through the process, the Thomas More Society had reached out to anti-abortion rights activists to say, we'll defend this law for free if this becomes a law and goes to the courts. And so they've been sort of offering that for a while now. And the Attorney General's office and some other officials agreed they would be best to defend the state in this case. And according to the Attorney General's office, they say their understanding is that this will come at no cost to the taxpayers of Iowa.
Mm-hmm. In this legal battle, the new law slated to take effect July 1st, do we have any sense of if the legal battle will stop the law from taking effect?
While the first hearing in this case is scheduled for June 1st in Polk County District Court, Planned Parenthood and the ACLU want a temporary injunction to block the law while this lawsuit is playing out. So pretty soon here in the next few weeks, we should know if that law is temporarily blocked from taking effect during the lawsuit.
Okay, IPR's Katarina Sestarek, thank you very much for an update on the legal battle surrounding the case.
Thanks, Ben.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Now on to perspectives on Iowa's new fetal heartbeat law from three Iowa lawmakers, each with very different views, a Democrat who is against the change, a Republican who voted for it, and a Republican who was one of six in his party who felt he could not support the new fetal heartbeat law. He couldn't join us live, so earlier I spoke with Representative Lee Hine, a Republican of Monticello, House District 96. I began by asking him why he voted against the fetal heartbeat bill.
Well, it comes from probably a personal experience, but the more I studied the bill, the more I felt it went just a little too far. I firmly believe that life begins at conception, but I also believe that it is a moral, a religious, and most of all, a family decision, and I believe that government should stay out of that decision-making process. Mm-hmm. And that's the way I answer most every email that I get, for whether they're pro-choice or pro-life. That is the response that I usually send back to them.
Now, you mentioned a personal experience feeding into your decision here. I think you've been public about this. I wonder if you would mind sharing a little bit more about that personal experience?
No, I guess you might say it's very, I don't want to say raw or an experience that our family just went through in the past couple of months, where our daughter was pregnant with her second child or second pregnancy, and at about 12 to 14 weeks, I believe it was, she did an ultrasound. Things weren't right. They proceeded to do some testing, and there was a diagnosis that the pregnancy more than likely would not go to term. They told her that she probably at any time could have a miscarriage. If it went to term, more than likely it would be a stillborn birth. And even if the pregnancy went to term and the baby was born alive, the odds were less than 1% that it would live over a couple hours after birth. And her and her husband went through the thought process and actually included me and my wife in it. And like I say, it was a very private family discussion that we made, but as this bill proceeded, and I and my daughter talked back and forth about where I was going to stand, and I felt it was pertinent that I let my constituents know probably one of the reasons why I was going to vote the way I was going to vote. I didn't want to put her in a position of having to come out public because of the time she hadn't. But she agreed that it was something that needed to be made public, and we went through a process of her telling her friends and people on Facebook what she had went through, and then I released our data and our information. And actually, I think it has helped her, because now it's kind of a topic that not a lot of people want to talk about that go through this. And I was very amazed at the amount of people that sent me emails and thanked me for my vote, because they had went through, and being public about our situation, they had been through the same things.
Now, this new law, I understand, correct me if I'm wrong, allows abortion for fetal anomalies. Specifically,
yep.
It says an abortion is allowed when, in the words of the law, the physician certifies that the fetus has a fetal abnormality that is, in the physician's reasonable medical judgment, incompatible with life. but we so that wasn't enough for you. You still say it's got to be more of a family decision.
And yeah, it just was one of those things where I really didn't have time. The amendment came at the very late stages of the vote. I didn't have felt I had enough time to research it and make sure that it was going to work for me or for those families that are going through this gut-wrenching decision. And there again, I don't think it needs to be the doctor's decision. I think it needs to be the family's decision.
Mm-hmm. You, Representative Hine, you broke with your party, so to speak, on this vote. You're one of six who did not vote for it, according to our calculations. How did your decision not to support this bill set with your fellow Republicans, most of whom voted for it?
Well, I would say that first and foremost, leadership supported me, and I think they supported everybody that voted no, as long as we let them know where we were at and why we were doing what we were doing. And so I didn't get any negative kickback from any of my caucus members. It was one of those decisions where leadership made it very clear it was up to each individual. We just needed to let them know where we were at as they went to bring it for a vote. I am amazed at the amount, while it is in the Republican platform that we try to save life, there was an amazing amount of Republicans that appreciated the vote that I took, and they're kind of like me. A life is precious, but it's not a black and white issue. And I think, in fact, I had a reporter ask me if there was room for pro-choice people in the Republican Party, and I would say absolutely there is room for us. We may not disagree or agree with everything, but you know, families and everybody don't agree on everything. So,
did the legal challenges yet to come to this law impact your decision as to whether to vote for it?
No, I would say not. There again, it gets. I supported the 20-week. I also supported getting the government payments out of the abortion issue. So I struggle with knowing that it's going to go to court, and the state could have to be on the hook to spend some money to defend it. There again, I think those are taxpayers' dollars that probably shouldn't go for something like that.
Okay. Representative Lee Hine, Republican of Monticello, thank you very much for being with us and sharing your thoughts on this very contentious issue.
Yep. I'm glad to do it.
That conversation with Representative Hine, recorded yesterday. He could not join us live. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, talking about the new Iowa law slated for a July 1st date, which bans physicians from performing most abortions after a fetal heartbeat is detected, the so-called fetal heartbeat law. And let's get a couple more lawmaker perspectives here in the remainder of this half hour. Representative Shannon Lundgren is with us, a Republican of Piasta, House District 57. Representative Lundgren, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be here today.
And Representative Amy Nielsen is with us of North Liberty, House District 77. She's a Democrat. Representative Nielsen, welcome to you.
Thanks, and hi, Representative Lundgren. Good to hear from you again.
Good to hear from you, too.
Let's start with you, Representative Lundgren. You were instrumental in getting this law passed. You ran the subcommittee for this bill. You were the floor manager. Why is this so important to you?
Well, you know, it's certainly one of the things that Republicans run on as a platform, and that's just defending all life from, you know, as early as conception till natural death. It was a platform that I ran on in my district. We're a pro-life district here in rural Dubuque County, a lot of Catholic families and churches out here. And so it was important to stand up and honestly speak for those children that don't have a voice to speak for themselves, because I'm pretty sure that if they had the opportunity to be asked the question whether or not they wanted to live or be aborted, we know what the answer would be.
Representative Nielsen, respond to that and tell us why you oppose this law.
First of all, it's blatantly unconstitutional. I think as early as recently as just 3 or 4 years ago, you know, there was already a court decision that upheld the constitutionality. It was 2016, you know, Whole Women's Health versus Hellerstedt, reaffirmed that abortion is constitutionally protected right for women. Abortion is safe and legal. It's been ruled over and over again. And, I said this on the floor, and I'll say it again. I do believe in a woman's right to choose, and I also would like to protect life and save babies. What it comes down to is that this is about a woman's right to choose. It is our law, and we need to respect that.
Okay. Representative Lundgren, is it your intention, was it your intention that this case would eventually overturn previous court precedents, most significantly Roe v. Wade from 1973?
Well, of course, anytime you pass legislation, your intent is that you want that law to stick. We certainly don't want to fight unnecessary court battles at an expense if we don't have to. But, you know, being realistic, we knew that it was certainly something that would be challenged. And at the time of the discussion, you know, one of the big questions that comes up is the cost to taxpayers, and I heard Representative Hine talk about that. But the Thomas More Foundation came out very early in session and stated that they would pay Iowa's court costs in regards to defending our heartbeat bill. And that was submitted in writing to both leadership in the House and Senate and our governor. And it just obviously recently came out in an article because our attorney general has recused himself from defending the law that the Thomas More Foundation will step in and do so. So, you know, there's certainly a legal battle looming. We're not the first state that's passed a heartbeat law. We certainly won't be the last. This could be in litigation for a long time. The biggest and probably most important part of the bill that we passed this year is it does keep our 20-week abortion ban intact, which prevents late-term abortions for pain-capable babies.
To you, Representative Nielsen, a Democrat and an opponent of this new law, you gained attention for wearing a T-shirt during a House debate on this bill. The shirt read, this is the quote I have, "The GOP, creating government small enough to fit inside your vagina." Why did you wear the shirt, and perhaps a little bit of explanation for that slogan?
Yeah. Well, I think the slogan is pretty self-explanatory. You know, we are, as Representative Lundgren said, we're not the first state to pass or try to enact some kind of law banning a woman's right to choose what to do with her own body. It was a statement that I felt very strongly about making. I didn't know if I would stand up on the floor and speak about this bill at the time. So I wanted to make sure that my opinion was well known to my colleagues in the House, and I think I accomplished that.
What was the reaction?
I had a few people come up and say that, you know, thank you for doing that. You know, I like your shirt. I got a lot of side eye, and one representative let me know that they were starting to work on changing the rules so that next year I would not be allowed to wear such a shirt on the floor. And then outside of the chamber, I got overwhelming positive reaction from Iowans, but also from people all across the country, just saying thank you for doing that. Thank you for standing up for my rights and the rights of my daughters.
Representative Lundgren, talk a little bit about the exceptions to this abortion ban, fetal heartbeat law, in cases of abnormalities, in the case of a medical emergency, for instance. Do you recognize a significant gray area that will be judged by physicians having different opinions about abnormalities or medical emergencies?
Well, you know, it's a risk you're always going to have to take. But quite honestly, by adding those exceptions, I don't know what human being could vote against that bill? You know, the biggest concern that we always hear is, I don't want to make this decision for a woman who is a victim of rape or a victim of incest. That's in there. Fetal abnormality, in the example of Representative Hines' story, you know, he certainly had something that was very close and dear to him with a decision to make. Again, we added that exception into the bill.
To the point about rape, we're running out of time. I'm very sorry to interrupt, but to the point about rape, I understand the bill says the rape needs to be reported within 45 days of the incident to a law enforcement agency or to a public or private health agency. What about women who are not ready to report a rape?
Well, you know, isn't that part of the problem that we have in our culture in the U.S. is that we make these women out to be, you know, the bad guy when this happens. And what we should be doing is encouraging them in every way, shape, and form, every one of us, Republicans, Democrats, Independents, Libertarian, Green Party, to stand up and support these women when they come forward and have a story about how they were raped or they were a victim of incest.
Women should not be forced to come out before they're ready. I mean, you talk about wanting to preserve life and protect people, protect babies. What about protecting women who have just been through the most violating, disgusting thing that can ever happen to a woman? And now the state of Iowa is forcing them to come out before they are ready.
Of course, we turn around and make two victims out of that situation. In that rare instance, when a rape happens and there is a pregnancy, now we've not only traumatized the rape victim once, but she's going to have to live with the fact that she's had an abortion and killed a baby for the rest of her life. So we're doing it twice. We're victimizing that woman twice.
Nobody forces a woman to have an abortion, though, Representative Lundgren. Nobody's forcing a woman to have an abortion. You're forcing a woman to come out and make a public statement and about one of the worst things that can happen to a woman, give details
that she may not
be ready for.
If they don't, then it's going to happen to the next woman.
We have
to encourage these women.
We shouldn't
force them into a time frame that they're not ready for. It's the time frame and the forcing a woman to come out before she's ready. It's not up to you. It's not up to me. It's not up to anyone to tell a woman when she's ready to come and report it. If she reports it within 50 days, it still doesn't happen to the next woman, but now that woman cannot go and make the decision that is best for her and her life.
I think we understand the points that the two of you are making. I wanted to finish up in this last minute by having you each please comment briefly on whether you see compromise here in the future. Representative Lundgren, please, just 30 seconds. Is there room for compromise on this?
It appears to me that the issue that the minority party, the Democrats in Iowa, are having with this is the time frame. So, of course, there's room for negotiation, it appears. Do I necessarily agree with that? Again, I think it's really important that we're encouraging women and providing the services so that they can come out in a comfortable setting and be protected, and that they can report what's happening to them. The statistics aren't there. We don't always know.
Okay.
I'm going to make sure
that Representative Nielsen has her 30 seconds. What about the issue going forward? Cooperation, compromise? What are your thoughts on that, Representative Nielsen?
Well, the minority party did try to compromise with the Republicans during the writing of this bill, and we were shut out at every turn, every corner. Representative Beth Wessel-Crichel offered numerous amendments to try to make this, a little bit softer to swallow, a little bit easier and better for women, but they wouldn't accept any. So as far as I'm concerned, I don't believe that there is room for compromise on the part of the Republicans.
Okay. Thank you very much. We've run out of time. Representative Amy Nielsen of North Liberty, a Democrat. Representative Shannon Lundgren, a Republican of Piasta. Thank you very much for participating in our conversation.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up in just a moment, we'll talk with a history professor at the University of Illinois, Urbana. She's the author of When Abortion Was a Crime, taking us back before the Roe v. Wade Supreme Court decision in 1973. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
Back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, perspectives on what's being called the most restrictive abortion ban in the nation, the new Iowa law. slated to go into effect July 1st. We have to mention the legal challenge is trying to prevent that. Bans physicians from performing most abortions after a fetal heartbeat is detected. In the first half hour, we heard details of that legal challenge. Also, we heard from lawmakers with several different views. Real sense in that last part of the segment, the strong emotions this debate entails. One of the largest medical teaching hospitals in the country is a perspective we wanted to hear. We turned to the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. University of Iowa media spokesperson Tom Moore told IPR that he had not received a response from any physician willing to talk with us. And when we asked whether hospital leadership could comment on how the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics is preparing for possible implementation of this law, we were given this statement, a statement from Josh Lehman, Senior Communications Director for the Iowa Board of Regents. Let me read this. Under this law, University of Iowa Healthcare will not be able to offer comprehensive training for its obstetrician gynecology residents. This will jeopardize its accreditation with the Accreditation Council for Graduate Medical Education, the ACGME. The University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine and Iowa Obstetrics and Gynecology Department is accredited by the ACGME. And in order to receive an ACGME accreditation, the UI's obstetrics and gynecology program is required to provide family planning training, including all forms of contraception and training in the provision of abortion if the student so chooses. Limitations on abortions in Iowa would eliminate the ability to meet training requirements. End of statement by Josh Lehman, of the Senior Communications Director for the Iowa Board of Regents. Well, for the remainder of the hour, we want to put this change in Iowa's abortion law up to a historical perspective. Leslie Regan is with us, history professor at the University of Illinois Urbana, author of When Abortion Was a Crime. Leslie, welcome to the program.
Hi. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you on this program. Of course, this has been contentious, I think, for a long time. We're going to get a little bit of perspective from you. We want to invite our listeners to join us with questions specifically about the history of abortions in this country. If you have anything, not the present, the history, please understand that. 1-866-780-9100. I think it's instructive, Leslie, if you would tell us about the research that went into this book and what your overall goal was before we do a sort of chronology.
Oh, okay. Well, when I began doing this research, really, I think most people just assumed it had always been a crime. It was against the law prior to the 70s when there were reform laws passed and the Roe versus Wade decisions with the Supreme Court. It had always been dangerous and hard to get. And really, we didn't know much at all about how the criminal abortion laws were enforced. And so my research was on the moment, the time when laws were passed in the 1860s and 1870s, up through Roe versus Wade, really asking a kind of simple and obvious question. Well, what happened when you made abortion illegal? Because it had been legal under common law. But what happened when you made it a crime? How were the laws enforced? Did it really stop? How did people go looking for abortions? How was it practiced? And what happened when it was made a crime? And so from that, and I was also told by many people, including archivists and historians, you will find nothing. There will be no information on this because it's shameful and against the law. But actually, when something's against the law, there were lots of records, criminal records, court records, inquests into deaths, lots of material in newspapers, medical literature, because physicians were always allowed to perform abortions for medical reasons. There was always a loophole written for them. And so that's what I did research on, was mm-hmm. to find out what happened when okay. it was made illegal.
It sounds like you identify the mid-1860s, mid-1800s as a place where the early laws came in. Comment quickly on before that, the time of our nation's founding, up to that time. And I get a sense from your book that this was, well, knowledge, practices that were passed from generations, mothers to daughters?
Yes. There's information passed from mothers to daughters to sisters, and there were domestic guidebooks that women would have in their families that you could buy and pass along. because women were the ones who took care of the general health care of the family. And within those are recipes and information about how to take care of all kinds of illnesses. But there would also be recipes about what to do when your menses were off, when there was a disturbance in your menstruation. And those recipes would be used to get your menses back. And that's how people talked about it. There was a disorder in the equilibrium of the body. And so those recipes, using herbs in the garden, bushes that you could find in the general area, would be used to bring order back to the body. What we would call an early abortion, but that wouldn't be the term that would have been used at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And this was very common. Then there were people who sold medicines and all in the 18th century and early 19th century. As we had more newspapers and more commercial products, there were advertisements in the newspapers in the 19th century saying, if you're having trouble with your monthly regulation, do come to this doctor or midwife, and we will solve this problem. We will fix it. Or buy these Chichester's pills. You could purchase these medicines, and it would sometimes say things like, if you're about to have a baby, do not buy these. So people, of course, would understand, if that's what I'm trying to avoid, this is definitely mm-hmm.
Was it the upswing in these the advertising of people who perform clinics, who perform abortions, that mm-hmm. that created this conservative reaction and the creation of laws?
Yeah. So under common law, English common law, there's all the early period was unregulated and sort of accepted, but at the point of quickening, when a woman could feel movement in her body, that would be understood as, life has begun. So when she could feel the kicking of the fetus. And that would depend on the woman herself, when she felt it, when she determined it. It's completely upon her sensitivity. So after that, after quickening, that was against the law, that was against morality, and there were certainly many stories of women themselves saying, they tried things. They were taking teas, they were doing hot sit baths, they were throwing themselves downstairs, and then they felt quickening and they stopped. Hmm. So there would be, people could be prosecuted if they did something after quickening. Also, it was much more dangerous, of course. I mean, people might be injured or die.
Yeah.
So then the first laws, to answer your question, well, there were clinics. There was a very famous woman, Madame Ristel in New York, who was performing abortions and making a lot of money and driving around in a carriage, and that was offensive. And the people going to her were the upper-class Yankee women. And they could see that they were getting abortions, they were having a smaller number of children, smaller family size, and they were out shopping, they were involved in politics, they were demanding to get into medical schools in the 1840s and 1850s. And meanwhile, immigrants were pouring into the country. There's concerns about the Chinese, the Irish, the Catholics, how big their families are. And the leaders of this movement to change the laws really originally come out of specialists in obstetrics and Harvard. That's what they point to. Who's going to settle our great prairies? Probably thinking of Iowa and further west. If our women don't have the number of children that they should be having. And so it really is focused on controlling their behavior, that they should be having more children. So that's why these laws are passed around the country in the 1860s and the 1870s, is to criminalize abortion from conception on.
If you just joined us, historian Leslie Regan is with us of the University of Illinois, author of When Abortion Was a Crime, giving us some historical perspective on the latest law change here in Iowa. About 10 minutes left, Leslie. Let's jump into the 20th century. Give us some 20th century landmarks on this issue.
Well, in terms of the enforcement, I mean, when we're talking about these kinds of cases, because obviously this law is intended to try to stop the practice of abortion, and I know I've read some things, so that's what the lawmakers are hoping. And certainly the long history of American history of this is the laws do not stop the practice of abortion. What it will put up are, as your earlier speakers were talking about, is creating a bureaucracy to enforce these new kinds of laws, and a bureaucracy that will specifically monitor what women are doing and monitor their bodies and monitor physicians and health personnel who are taking care of them. And we saw this earlier. So women, in terms of enforcing the law, women were not prosecuted for having abortions, very few. Mostly they prosecuted practitioners, doctors, midwives, and all the other people who got in the business to make money because there was no regulation. It was against the law. But they also interrogated women in hospitals. They got doctors to call in police or ask them themselves, who did this to you? Name the person or I won't treat you. And to ask them questions. They threatened to arrest them. And any woman who had a miscarriage, this started in the 1900s and it went right up to 1973. Anybody who came in with a miscarriage into the emergency room, they questioned them. You had an abortion. Who did it? Who was the man you had sex with? How far along were you? What instrument did they use?
Up to the 1970s.
Yep. And this actually propelled some women straight into becoming very active in the movement to legalize it, became very active in Planned Parenthood or other organizations, was because of this, because of what happened to them when they had a miscarriage, was they found out how they were being treated. It also affected doctors who were not able to take care of their patients. Creates a wedge between health providers and women. So it'll create those kinds of things. It also creates, if people can't get care, there's a real, you know, three-tier system of people doing it themselves, which we know already happens in states where they cannot find abortion providers or have to, you know, do 48-hour waiting periods. Poor women end up doing things themselves, cases of teenagers asking their boyfriends to beat them up. I mean, awful things.
Well, let me go back to a point you made to have you elaborate on, and I think you made a comment about the relationship between the law, more restrictive, less restrictive over time in American history on abortion, and lower rates of abortion. You're saying, do you have data that indicates more restrictive laws mean fewer abortions?
Well, no, I don't think it does mean fewer.
Some would say it stands to reason if that there are people alive today because having an abortion was not as easy as it might have been.
Oh, no. Well, there may be some people who got married and had children in the 50s and didn't have an abortion. But plenty of women in the 50s had abortions, no matter how hard it was to get. So what those numbers are of who didn't, it's impossible to get an accurate number. But I can give you some estimates that there were maybe 2 million a year. There were estimates like that in 1900. There were estimates like that of over a million illegal abortions in the 50s.
How do you get data on illegal abortions?
You can't get exact numbers. But Kinsey and his studies in 1958 that found that probably a fifth of all pregnancies ended in an abortion. He found that young wives, almost a third of them had had abortions, a third of their pregnancies, and separated, divorced, and widowed women, it was a very high number of their pregnancies were aborted. So there's extremely high numbers. And really what people have thought is that the number, when abortion becomes legal and the numbers are visible because they start counting them, the CDC begins counting them, really what you're seeing is the number of illegal abortions become legal and visible. Because prior to that, we have plenty of evidence of illegal abortion through court records, through underground clinics. You know, there was an underground clinic in Chicago that was visible. It was a women's liberation clinic. They did 11,000 abortions over a couple of years. There's an underground clinic in San Francisco that sent over 12,000 women for abortions to Mexico over a couple of year period. So we know that there's huge numbers, and there's just but even if their goal is to manage to stop a few, the price for everybody else is, and what we know we did have prior to the legalization in the United States, was hospitals like Cook County Hospital in Chicago, big public hospitals across the country, had an entire ward devoted to septic abortion cases. So 5,000 women a year in Chicago at Cook County Hospital.
Septic meaning?
Meaning infected. Possibly will die because of the infection.
Okay.
Hemorrhaged, injured. Many of those are self-induced. Some of them have gone to somebody who doesn't do a good job. 100 every week in Los Angeles. Those wards that were devoted solely to taking care of women who were badly injured, infected, highly like, you know, maybe they die. Don't exist anymore. We do not have them anymore in this country. And you know, in countries where it's illegal, that still exists. 25% of, and also when it was legalized, maternal mortality dropped by 45%.
Historian,
it's incredible.
5 minutes left, Leslie. Yeah. That's why I'm breaking in here. Historian Leslie Regan is with us of the University of Illinois, author of When Abortion Was a Crime. I wanted to have you take us up to Roe v. Wade. We have that tossed around in our news so much. Give us in a nutshell what was actually decided so that we can, when we're talking about overturning Roe v. Wade, we can give a little historical perspective, understanding on what that decision actually decided.
Well, Roe v. Wade recognized that the decision for an abortion was based on privacy and a decision that a woman could make with her doctor. And it saw pregnancy, it divided the decision across three trimesters. But later decisions really allowed the states to recognize an interest in the fetus. And that's what this kind of law attempts to do, is to really get away from thinking about women who are carrying a pregnancy. And that decision was rooted in exactly what your first lawmaker, the Republican, was talking about, was a movement from the 60s that really began around talking about families make these complicated decisions, and a long, long history of women and families with their doctors and their midwives thinking about what was best for them, what was best for the child, and a long tradition of Americans really morally having a moral acceptance of this practice when people reach their own conclusions based in certain situations. And also an understanding that these are private decisions. And there are religious views, and then there's the government. And separating the government from your moral and religious views. Anything that's this divided is not something we all agree upon, that the government can make a determination for everybody else. And that's really where Roe versus Wade came out of, is this long history of, I think, doctors and women working together to perform abortions and for the horrible public health consequences of the criminal abortion laws.
Do we know whether in the wake of Roe v. Wade there was a spike in legal abortions?
No, I don't think you can call it a spike. What you saw, because it was already legalized in several states. First there were reform laws, and then there was an increase in legal abortions. And what that means is when it becomes legal, there were more legal abortions done by doctors in hospitals. But there were also illegal abortions done by doctors and by people who were not doctors, who were safe and self-induced. And then it was legalized in New York in particular. It was very important because you didn't have to live in New York to get abortions there. And they had 65% of the abortions there were from out of state. They had millions of people coming, thousands of people coming in from out of state. So that dropped the mortality level immediately. So they had a lot of clinics being set up in New York, and they were you know, helping women from all over the country and from out of the country. I mean, Canadians are coming into New York rather than going to illegal practitioners in Canada.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask, it sounds like you heard the first part of our program, the contentious words between our lawmakers there at the end of the first half hour. Compromise, finding a middle ground doesn't seem to be something, it seems to be, on this issue, have for decades been far away from it. Has that always been true in American history, that it's so divided, so contentious, so lacking in common ground or a search for it?
Yeah, thank you for asking. That's a really good question, because actually I think you're the first speaker also exemplified the earlier Roe versus Wade and also the earlier reform laws and the repeal in New York in 1970, is this was not a partisan issue. Republicans and Democrats voted to change the laws and to legalize abortion. And there were Republicans and Democrats who were opposed to it. So it was not partisan in this way. We are in a particularly heated moment that uses abortion to talk about sexuality and family and changes in gender and race and a whole lot of other things.
Okay. Leslie Regan, unfortunately, we've run out of time. A fascinating conversation, area of study that you have. History professor at the University of Illinois, Urbana, author of When Abortion Was a Crime. Thank you for explaining some of the facets, historical facets of the abortion debate in this country and laws and so forth.
Thanks so much.
Coming up tomorrow on the program, it's a News Buzz edition of our program. Clay Masters will be joining me to talk about the candidates for governor, also that exit of Nate Bolton ahead of the June 5th primary. A former Iowa resident, John Little, will share his view of the active volcano on Hawaii. That's where he now lives. Also addressing the problem of overcrowded cemeteries tomorrow on the program. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Ben Stanton, and Lindsay Moon with help from Natalia Reyes. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.